And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Pro sports legend Lamar Hunt, who brought the Kansas City Chiefs to both the local and national stages, once said he couldn't separate what part of pro football is business and what part is personal. Either way, he said it's very important that he succeed. And time and experience has proven that Lamar Hunt has indeed succeeded. And joining us now from St. Louis is Michael McCambridge, author of the book Lamar Hunt, A Life in Sports, a very detailed portrait of the legendary Kansas City Chiefs owner who founded the American Football League, which later merged with the NFL. He's also credited, among other things, with helping to create the Super Bowl. Welcome to Central Standard, Michael McCambridge.
Good to be with you, Jabalani.
Tell us about the book Lamar Hunt, A Life in Sports. Seems so long overdue. How did you come about starting the process of writing this book?
I had spent some time with Lamar while I was writing my previous book, which was a book about pro football called America's Game. I spent 5 years writing that book and probably visited him in Dallas a half dozen times. We talked for about 25 hours in all. And I recognized then that there was really a need for chronicling Lamar's contributions to the world of sports, because in addition to all he did in football, he's also inducted in the Tennis Hall of Fame, is really the patron saint of American soccer, and is in the National Soccer Hall of Fame, one of the original owners of the Chicago Bulls. And it became clear that the story of Lamar's life was also, to a great extent, the story of the rise of spectator sports in the second half of 20th century America.
In bringing that up, you sort of discovered that you can't talk about the history of pro football without mentioning Lamar Hunt's pivotal role in it.
That's certainly true. I think that, you know, when people were reading his obituaries in late December of 2006, the first thing that was mentioned was founder of the American Football League, then owner of the Chiefs, and the man who gave the Super Bowl its name. And those were all extraordinarily important. I think that the deeper I got into the study of his life, the thing that really stands out in terms of his influence on pro football and all sports was his decision when he was starting the American Football League to convince his fellow AFL owners to share television revenue equally. That was not a huge deal at the time, because the TV money was significant but not exorbitant. But in later years, as the television money grew exponentially, the principle of sharing those revenues equally among all the teams in the league, which inaugurated with the AFL and was imitated a year later by the NFL, was just crucial in guaranteeing competitive balance, in allowing the Kansas Cities and Indianapolises and Green Bays to compete with the New Yorks and Chicagos. You know, Bob Costas, the broadcaster, wrote a book about baseball about 10 years ago, and he wrote in that book, "Baseball owners are still fighting today over things football owners settled 40 years ago." And they settled those things because of Lamar Hunt's lead.
Speaking of Lamar Hunt's lead, he had a lead from his early life as the son of a Texas oil tycoon. How did that influence his philosophy on business and then later his career trajectory?
It's really interesting because Lamar was the youngest son in the Hunt family, and it was like there was this epic movie going along, and he arrived halfway through it. You know, H.L. Hunt had already been a billionaire a couple times over before Lamar was born, and so there was a sense that Lamar was tagging along for the ride. I think to answer your question specifically, the people who worked with him at Hunt Oil after he got out of college in the mid and late 50s, almost to a man, said he just had no real interest in the oil business. It didn't capture his imagination. And the idea of taking a sizable fortune and making it a more sizable fortune was not something that really had any appeal to him. He was a sports fan first. He was intrigued with creating new sports enterprises, and so he went a different way. Now, where I think it comes into play is he did respect his father. He did he did respect the options that he had that most people didn't have because he was the son of a billionaire. So he was always trying to make pro football sound economically. As he put it at the time, we are not looking to get wildly rich, but we are not going into this on a charity basis. He felt it was very important for it to be a serious enterprise, that it eventually be something that could operate in the black.
What obstacles did he face in setting up an entirely new football league? We saw the sort of disintegration of people trying to set up leagues with the USFL, with Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation trying to set up the XFL. What was so successful about this new league back in the golden age of American football? Setting that up, what is now the AFC, the AFL?
I think that the two things that stand out is he got everyone on board to buy in of the eight AFL owners. They cast their lots in together. You know, after Lamar announced the launch of the American Football League, he literally had a half dozen or a dozen opportunities to jump to the National Football League, because the same owners that wouldn't let him have a franchise in 1959, once they realized he was starting a whole other league, were full of these back-channel offers to, you know, take an NFL franchise and kill off the AFL. But at that point, he was committed to the other owners, his partners in this new league, and he stood by the AFL. And the ability to have everyone have some income from television that first year was crucial. The eight AFL teams, which had just been formed out of whole cloth, had no tradition, had no sense of loyalty among their in their various and sundry markets. All eight AFL teams made more money than five of the 13 NFL teams in 1960 from TV, and that was because of the joint television contract. So that was a huge factor. And then Lamar hung in through losing millions in the first couple of years of the 60s.
Tell us about the Dallas Texans versus the Dallas Cowboys in the Cathedral of Football, Texas, and how that conflict between the AFL and the NFL sort of has its roots in that.
There had been an NFL team in Dallas in 1952, and it drew horribly, and it didn't even finish the season. It went under before the end of the year and left Dallas. So when Lamar was trying to get an NFL expansion franchise, the owners were not at all interested in Dallas, didn't think it was a good market. But once he announced the launch of the AFL, and once it appeared as though the AFL was actually going to get off the ground, the NFL owners voted to put a franchise in Dallas to compete with the AFL directly. So you had this city that went from overnight from having zero pro football franchises to two pro football franchises. And it almost guaranteed that neither one of them would be entirely successful. And so the war between those two teams over those early years was legendary. There's another writer, John Eisenberg, who just wrote a book specifically about that three-year period in which the Texans were battling the Cowboys. And they would do anything they could. One year, the Cowboys played a home game on Friday night. And so what the Texans did in response, I think this was Lamar's idea, offered a free entry to anybody who had a ticket stub from a high school football game that week. Well, all the high school football games were played on Friday night, so it was people who'd not gone to the Cowboys game got in free to the Texans games. Another time he had what was called Friend of the Barber Day. Lamar thought, barbers talk to a lot of different people. Let's get the barbers on our side. So free admission to the barbers. Well, at the gate, that soon deteriorated into free admission to anybody wearing a white smock, and eventually free admission to anyone wearing a white business shirt. So it was the original whiteout that they have in basketball in 1961 in Dallas, Texas.
And we see a lot of those very shrewd promotional initiatives coming from Lamar Hunt throughout his career as a professional sports owner and a sports impresario. Now, let's get to the nitty-gritty of what may be on the minds of some of our listening audience here in Kansas City. How did the Dallas Texans become the Kansas City Chiefs? Now, we set an interesting scene in this book with Mayor H. Roe Bartle of Bartle Hall fame now here in Kansas City. Talk about Mayor H. Roe Bartle's courtship of Lamar Hunt, which led to the Kansas City Chiefs.
Well, Mayor Bartle knew that one of the definitions of being a major league city was having a professional football team. He also knew that Lamar Hunt was losing a lot of money with the Texans, even as the Texans were winning the AFL title in 1962. He contacted Lamar during that 62 season, and Lamar put him off because he knew that it would be horrible publicity and would be a killer if he was seen to be looking at other markets during the season. But he called him the day after the Texans won the 1962 AFL title, and Lamar took this sort of surreptitious, beneath-the-radar trip to Kansas City, was met by one of the mayor's limousines, taken to the office. Everything was hush-hush. They went for a dinner at one of the private clubs in Kansas City.
And the Kansas City Club, which is right there downtown. Yeah.
Yeah. And Lamar was there. The second trip, Lamar was there with Jack Stedman. And Bartle, who was probably nobody's idea of a genius double agent, his alias for Lamar Hunt was Mr. Lamar. And his alias for Jack Stedman was Jack X.
Wow.
He told people that Stedman was in town with the IRS investigating income tax evasion. So that caused any curious businessmen to stay as far away from Stedman as they could.
Especially in a place like Kansas City.
I think that there had been an interest in moving the franchise to New Orleans, but Mayor Bartle made the pitch for Kansas City, made a deal, agreed to build the Chiefs' offices there in Swope Park on 63rd Street, and Lamar made the decision to move. And it was crucial in the development of the AFL because suddenly this flagship franchise could be a healthy franchise rather than a franchise operating on two cylinders in the two-team town of Dallas. And also it was huge in the development of Kansas City and its reputation nationally.
And there was a condition, because Lamar Hunt was a very shrewd man, there was a condition for him finally moving his team here once they announced that they would be moving the franchise to Kansas City. He said, ever the businessman, he says, if Kansas City could prove to him that they could sell 25,000 season tickets by May, and it was February at the time of the announcement, so February to May, he said he would finalize a move. Apparently things worked out, but give us the details on that.
Well, it was one of those things, you know, they talk about your mouth writing a check that your butt can't cash.
Right.
I think Kansas City was guilty of that, but in fairness to the city, the city was also helping the Kansas City Athletics and Charlie Finley with a season ticket drive that was going on in February and March. So they couldn't really start pushing the Chiefs season ticket drive until the baseball season started. They wound up selling only about 15,000 season tickets, and so they fell short of the goal. But Lamar moved the team anyway because 15,000 was a greater season ticket sale than any American Football League franchise had yet, and it was much greater than what he'd had in Dallas, so it was still a sensible economic decision.
You just mentioned Charlie Finley, who we should clarify was the owner of the Kansas City Athletics, which later became the Oakland A's, and he actually had something to say to Lamar Hunt before Lamar moved his Dallas Texans franchise, which later became the Kansas City Chiefs. Charlie Finley was telling Lamar Hunt, don't come here.
Yeah, he said at their first meeting, first time he met Hunt, he tried to talk him into both of them moving their franchises to Louisville. Finley's words were, this is a horseshit town and nobody will be successful here. Lamar, to his credit, decided to give it a shot anyway.
Yeah. That's an interesting assessment of Charlie Finley, and we know how he actually felt once he picked up the team and left to Oakland. But there's a funny anecdote from your book about the quarterback of the Dallas Texans, which later became a legendary Hall of Fame quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Lynn Dawson. He famously said of Kansas City when they found out they were moving to Kansas City, he said, which one? Kansas City, Missouri or Kansas City, Kansas? He had no idea there were two cities in one. Talk about the perception, besides what Charlie Finley had said, talk about the perception of some of the players and fans and the coach, Hank Schramm, upon the move to Kansas City.
You've got to remember that the Dallas Texans, the team that won the AFL title in 62, had a lot of native Texans on their team. The great running back Abner Haynes had been signed by the Texans. The NFL wanted him, but he chose to play in Dallas because it was close to home. There were players like Jerry Mays who'd gone to SMU, and they were playing in their hometown and they loved it. All of a sudden, after winning the title and thinking they had finally beaten the Cowboys, they find out a few months later that the Cowboys aren't leaving town, the Texans are leaving town. And so there were a lot of people who were upset at moving at all. Then you had the reputation of Kansas City, which was, it still had a significant cowtown reputation, had a reputation as kind of a minor league city. And in fairness, the performance of the Kansas City Athletics under Charlie Finley only furthered that reputation as a minor league city. And certainly back east, Lynn Dawson said the friends that he talked to gave him this vision of, you know, livestock walking down Main Street.
Right.
Like something out of the Wild West. And so that's why, you know, that's why it was so crucial for the team to come to Kansas City at that time, because it helped raise the profile of the city. It helped to introduce people to things like the plaza and the architecture and the fact that it wasn't just a cow town anymore, and the Chiefs had a lot to do with that.
Talk about what some of the early team mascot name proposals. That was a very funny and very whimsical passage of your book bandied about for the new team here in Kansas City at the time. The Meat Packers, the Mocans, the American Royals. Coach, yeah, Hank Schramm even suggested something totally blasphemous, the Kansas City Texans. So tell us how the Chiefs got their name.
Schramm and Lamar Hunt were originally for keeping the nickname. Lamar reasoned that the Minneapolis Lakers moved to Los Angeles and remained the Lakers, even though Los Angeles is not particularly known for its lakes.
No, not at all.
But obviously,
and the Dodgers.
But to Jack Stedman's credit, he said he was spending time in Kansas City. Lamar was still living in Dallas, but Stedman had essentially moved up to Kansas City. And Stedman said, "Lamar, we cannot name the team the Kansas City Texans." And so there was a write-in contest that the Kansas City Star held, and there were, yes, meat packers, mules, steers, donkeys. There were even a few suggestions of reprising the old Kansas City Monarchs nickname. That came up as well. But the one that made the most sense was Chiefs, and it had the added benefit of Chief was Mayor Bartle's nickname, and he had been so instrumental in persuading the franchise to move there that was the nickname that was chosen. And then the other part of the story, Lamar, who had he was quite a good sketch artist, and when I went back and looked at his old papers and stuff from college, he was very good at this architecture class and drawing the different types of columns. He was very good at drawing stadium elevations and things, and he sat in his kitchen one day in the summer of 63 and sketched out an arrowhead with an interlocking KC in it, and that became that distinctive logo that's still on the helmet today. No graphic designers, no art departments, no marketing firms, just Lamar on the back of a napkin.
And that's a very interesting story, and we learn a lot of interesting stories in the book, Lamar Hunt, A Life on Sports, a very detailed account of the life of former Kansas City Chiefs owner, who was also a sports legend. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're on with the author, Michael McCambridge of that book, Lamar Hunt, A Life in Sports. Talk about why the city was slow to embrace the Chiefs in the first couple of seasons. Why?
I think there were a couple of factors in the mid-60s. First of all, the city had a bit of distrust for out-of-town owners based on experience with Charlie Finley. The Chiefs, although they had been much hyped, had some trouble with injuries, some narrow losses, so they had a disappointing record in 63 and 64. There were also, you've got to remember, this was a time of terrible conflict between the AFL and the NFL. You know, the general manager of the Dallas Cowboys, Tex Schramm, who was this cold warrior. You know, when Tex Schramm would be talking about the war in the 60s, he didn't mean Vietnam. He was talking about the AFL and the NFL. And in the minds of Schramm and other people, this was a fight to the death. And so in the midst of the Chiefs trying to find their way in Kansas City, there were all these rumors about attendance was not as good as it should be. Maybe Lamar's going to move the team to Los Angeles. And the team had been disappointing on the field. It wasn't really until the end of the 65 season, after the tragic death of Mack Lee Hill, the running back, that the city really embraced the Chiefs, and you got the sense that the team was around to stay.
We're talking about the origins of the Kansas City Chiefs and the man who helped invent the Kansas City Chiefs, as well as found the American Football League, which later became the American Football Conference, which later was part of a merged NFL, the legend in sports, local sports, and national sports, Lamar Hunt. A Life in Sports is the name of the book. We're on with Michael McCambridge, the author. Michael, we actually have somebody on the line from Overland Park who wants to talk about his experience with Lamar Hunt. Larry in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. It's a very interesting program. Randy Neal and myself and Bill Thomas and several other young men from were cheerleaders at the KU and got the idea, primarily to Randy Neal, that why don't we call Lamar Hunt and see if we can set up a cheerleading squad for the Chiefs. And call was made. He was very cooperative. We got to participate in all the promotions. We had cars. We were able to provide uniforms. He provided uniforms. And it was just really a great experience working with him. I was with the cheerleading squad for 2 years. I think it went on for one more, and then it switched to what we see today. But it was a great opportunity. We got to see a lot of the games, all the home games, and to meet a lot of the players, and just had a really fantastic time.
Thank you very much, Larry, for your contribution to the conversation. We just heard from Larry in Overland Park, who helped Lamar Hunt set up the first cheerleading squad for the Kansas City Chiefs. We've been talking about the origins of the Kansas City Chiefs and Lamar's Hunt Life in Sports with author Michael McCambridge. Now, let's talk about 1970 and move forward toward 1970 there, Michael. It was a bittersweet moment in 1970 when the Chiefs became the first champions from the original AFL league in the merged NFL, but it was also the same year the league was absorbed into the NFL. Talk about that transition from the AFL into a merged NFL and how it affected Lamar Hunt.
The merger was announced in 66, but
right.
With the announcement of the merger, there was going to be a four-year process before the leagues fully came together. And so the last year of the old AFL was the 69 season. The Chiefs beat the defending world champion New York Jets in the first round of the playoffs. Then they go out to Oakland to play their arch rivals, the Raiders, and win that game. And then they go down to New Orleans, Tulane Stadium, for Super Bowl IV. And they beat the Minnesota Vikings. And finally, at that point, the AFL is going to get the respect it deserved. Even the year before, after the Jets upset the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III, if you go back and look at the literature at the time, what was in newspapers and magazines, there was a feeling that that game had been a fluke. A lot of the Colts said if we played the Jets 10 times, we'd win 9 of the games. But when a year later the Chiefs pushed the Vikings all over the field, finally the AFL was granted the respect it deserved, and at that very same moment, it ceased to exist because all 10 of the AFL franchises were then folded into the National Football League and were joined by three NFL teams in, as you pointed out, the retooled American Football Conference. So it was very bittersweet for Lamar. On one hand, he was on top of the world. He had, in before his 40th birthday, not only challenged the new league, but brought the not only challenged the old league, but brought this new league into being and achieved parity and won a title. But now the AFL was no more.
Something else that people may not know: Arrowhead Stadium was once the NFL's most modern stadium. We talked about in this segment, we talked about how Lamar Hunt sketched the Arrowhead on a napkin with the KC logo inside of it, and that's become the ubiquitous logo we see around this town and around this region and a big seller in the NFL in general. Talk about what was once NFL's most modern stadium and Hunt's love of architecture and how it led to Arrowhead and the Kauffman being right next to each other.
You got to remember that in the 60s, as spectator sports was growing, there were a lot of stadiums built around the country. But in almost every case, in St. Louis, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they were these round, multi-purpose stadiums. And these stadiums were okay for baseball, but they were really not suited for football because the nature of the shape of the stadium meant that a lot of seats were really far away from the football field. So Lamar and his president and general manager, Jack Stedman, worked very hard on creating a multi-sport complex, one stadium just for football, one stadium just for baseball, that would have sight lines tailored to each individual sport. And that was the genius of the Harry S. Truman Sports Complex. And the reason that that sports complex is still around now is because of that decision to build two stadiums. I'm convinced that if Kansas City would have built just one, it would have been bulldozed by now, and they would have built separate stadiums elsewhere. But it was a great idea to put one big parking lot between the two stadiums and have the baseball stadium be perfect for baseball, the football stadium perfect for football, every seat facing the 50-yard line. You just didn't have that in the other cities that had to deal with their ugly, cookie-cutter, dual-purpose stadiums.
Moving on from football, Lamar Hunt is often exclusively associated with football, but tell us about, number one, his early ownership stake in the Chicago Bulls, and then also his enthusiasm for soccer and tennis, two international sports whose pro leagues he also had a hand in turning around. Talk about some of his forays into other sports.
He had a chance to invest in the expansion franchise in the NBA in Chicago, and he was one of the original investors. And when he died, he was the only original investor still with a stake in the Bulls. And he patiently waited decades for that team to turn profitable. One of, I think, the great experiences for him in the 90s was going up to Chicago and watching Michael Jordan and the Bulls' playoff runs. He loved that a lot. But I think it's interesting. The merger was announced in June 8 of 1966.
The merger between the NFL and the AFL.
Between the NFL and the AFL. So in 7 years, he had achieved his grandest dreams in football. And within just a couple of months, he became enchanted with soccer. He watched the 1966 World Cup final on TV, in which England defeated West Germany, and fell in love with soccer. And he was also approached by a businessman from New Orleans named David Dixon, and who sold him on the possibilities of pro tennis. So he invested in that. Dixon soon ran out of money, and Lamar suddenly had a stable of 32 tennis players and the forerunner to the modern tennis tour. So it was like, even at his busiest and most successful, he took on these other challenges. And soccer truly, you know, he is the patron saint of American soccer. He's the reason that American soccer is enjoys the position it does today. And by the way, if he were still alive and interviewing with you today, Jabalani, he would tell you that the soccer ball used at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa shares your name.
Yeah, the official Jabalani ball.
Yes.
I get to tell people all the time that I'm slightly above it from search engine optimization standpoint, which is good. It's a ball. Speaking of soccer, Lamar Hunt's legacy can be found in Columbus, Ohio with the Columbus Crew and even across state lines with the new Sporting KC franchise, which used to be the Wizards, which he once owned, which ironically happens to currently be the most successful local pro sports franchise in the last 2 years. Talk about that.
You know, Lamar and his partners in the North American Soccer League lost millions and millions and millions of dollars when the NASL went under in 1984. And even through the last years of that league, he was arguing for an economic structure more similar to what the AFL had, more equal revenue sharing among the teams so everybody could compete on equal footing. And the league just it went in the other direction. It was top heavy with teams like the New York Cosmos playing in front of 80,000 fans at Giant Stadium, while the team in St. Louis, the Stars, wound up playing some of its games at a Division III football stadium on the campus of Washington University in St. Louis. So it had that just totally top heavy, uneven, and it was guaranteed to fail. But in 1995, after the World Cup had been so successful in the United States the year before, Lamar agreed to be the first important investor in another effort, Major League Soccer. And he made sure that Major League Soccer was going to have an economic structure that made sense, that was going to allow it to get through those very difficult early years. And if you follow soccer at all, you know that the first 7 or 8 years in Major League Soccer were very difficult. But through it all, he had faith that soccer was going to catch on in America. And I think over the last couple of years, we're starting to see evidence of that. Not just with the Nielsen ratings that you saw in the World Cup and the Women's World Cup, but with the sort of scenes you see out at Livestrong Sporting Park.
Right.
Seattle last weekend, they had 67,000 people for a soccer game, for a Major League Soccer game. And you're really starting to see the sport attain critical mass in America now. And Lamar envisioned that,
and I'm
even
sure,
when very few other people did.
And I'm sure Lamar Hunt would appreciate the sweet irony of having the former commissioner of NFL Europe, now the commissioner of Major League Soccer. We've actually had him here on the show. And a football guy, yeah, the Dapper Don, a football guy comes in to take over the soccer league and try to give it the same panache as the NFL.
And Garber had a tremendous amount of respect for Lamar. He said, I think I quote him on this in the book, he said, "Lamar was not a larger-than-life figure, but he had larger-than-life accomplishments." And it was that the common man with the uncommon touch that's a theme that runs through this book.
We're talking with Michael McCambridge, author of the book Lamar Hunt, A Life in Sports. The book paints a very detailed portrait of the legendary Kansas City Chiefs owner who founded the American Football League, which later merged with the NFL. And he's also credited with creating the Super Bowl. And Michael McCambridge calls him the patron saint of Major League Soccer. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure, Jabalani.
Thank you. Tune in tomorrow as we open up a discussion about the politics, challenges, and triumphs pervading the local transgender community. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is next with U.S. Senator Roy Blunt, plus a look at Kansas City jazz and blues, past, present, and future. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.